welcome back to Things We Read This Week. We're here with episode number 10. My name is Jordan Manos. I'm back with Hunter Ongren. We got a good show for you this week. We're going to cover an update on the OpenAI versus New York Times lawsuit. They are potentially deleting some evidence accidentally. Accidentally. Comments from Jensen in videos saying that we're years away from AI we can trust. Trends with AI agents, Google spinning off Chrome at the behest of the Department of Justice. And for those watching on YouTube, you'll know the question I'm about to ask, Hunter. Hunter, what was it that you would say you did last week?
I took the specs from the customers and I gave them to the engineers. Same thing I do every day. I'm a people person.
People person, indeed. Lots of people at SC24. It was a good week.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. A lot of good conversations, a lot of cool stuff released, a lot of people saying AI minimum of 10 times in every sentence. It is interesting to me how supercomputing, you know, started as like a small group of labs people, you know, just sharing information on how they solve super complex problems in the HPC space to, you know, Microsoft bringing a fucking robot coffee maker in and going, check out what AI can do. You know, like that's how
a robot coffee maker changed. Relates to, you know, high performance computing, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good, man. I think there continues to be a larger and larger presence of like traditional enterprise organizations at SC. A lot of the conversations are like, you know, last year was a lot of, you know, former Bitcoin miners who were saying, this is my first supercomputer. This time it was all like insurance companies, manufacturing companies. Whether it's the organization attending for the first time, it was a lot of people attending for the first time, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And then I talked to a friend at HPE who was wearing an SC97 shirt.
Yeah, we were sitting with that guy.
Yeah, Christian, he was like, yeah. He was saying, yeah, I guess it's coming up on his 30-year anniversary of coming to SC. I think the conference has been around for at least that long. So a lot of people have seen trends. I had another conversation with a guy who said that he was recalling when he worked at a startup in the late 80s that was building a floating point accelerator because they saw a need for, you know, building specific computational elements to accelerate FP32 workloads. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there, I'm like, okay, so this is a GPU? He sits there, he goes, I guess. Yeah. We didn't really think about it that way, but yeah, that's what the NVIDIA GPUs have turned into, man. No, a GPGPU oxymoron. Purpose graphics processing.
Yeah, I think that the trend of like more and more traditional enterprise companies attending stuff like supercomputing is going to continue because, as we've talked about in previous episodes, right, as HPC continues to creep its way further and further into the enterprise space, a lot of these people are dealing with this for the first time. So they're coming to SC basically to learn from like a one-on-one level, like, how do I manage? How do I build? How do I maintain? Like, these are all questions that I have that I have no answers to because I've been living in three-tier Ethernet land forever.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the amount of people who want to build a GPU cluster and then just connect it to their 25 gig fabric.
I know.
It's like, and the amount of HPC people who have been referring to InfiniBand or other things as an interconnect to avoid the networking team for so long. Mm-hmm. No. I'll just stay by myself.
It's not a switch. Yeah. It's an interconnect.
I don't need any IPs. Don't worry. it's interesting, man. I think it's a pretty good segue into the first story that we want to talk about. You shared it with me. The update on the OpenAI versus New York Times lawsuit. It's like when research labs try to come from HPC world and doing research and bring it into the enterprise, they run into lawyers sometimes.
Yeah. It's just interesting, right? Because interesting to me that, like, I don't know. Part of me is like, how do you unintentionally erase data in 2024, right? Like, I get that accidents happen, but like, I question whether this was actually accidental or this was, well, there's no case without any evidence, so we're going to continue using New York Times data to train our models. See ya.
Yeah, and I think we've given our thoughts on the general stuff, but let me actually talk about the technology side for a second. I do think it's not accidental. People are probably removing the French package, on purpose. But like, just a comment, the there is a significant trend in AI of people running out of space on their file system.
Sure.
Like, AI is certainly, in my experience, a game of scalability as opposed to performance on the storage side. People will, get frustrated if it takes 10 minutes to copy the model from the remote file system to the local drive, and then they'll launch their experiments, and who cares, right? Because the experiments run for hours, days, even months at a time. But there's a lot of people who run out of space and can't really expand. And the idea that like a research lab is deleting lots of data, like, version 16 of the data prep job that created the data set that that version of the model was trained on, kind of goes away when they have to clean up for some new training run, is like, that's actually totally plausible. It's a little too convenient in this case, but I did want to comment on the technology there, because I mean, a lot of what I have done with organizations who are training big models is like expansions. Hey, we've got our first quote unquote tranche of GPUs, we need more. We laid down some storage, we need to expand. We put down this thing without an interconnect, now we need to add an interconnect. Like, they're kind of building the plane as they fly it with these clusters sometimes.
The thing is, though, it's like one of the other thoughts that came to mind when I first read that story was, isn't there like a concept of a legal hold? Like, I mean, I've been through lawsuits, right? Like, where it's, hey, you can't delete any emails, messages, or whatever from the last 3 years, right? Like, and like, where was that, right? Or like, how does this end up? I don't know, getting people in the mindset of like, hey, maybe there should be more regulations to prevent things like this from not happening anymore. Like, that was one of my thoughts is like, A, where was the legal hold if there was one? And B, are there consequences from this situation? I'm not talking specific to OpenAI, but just in general, right? Do we have to start retaining massive amounts of old data from training runs that are could be 30 versions old, and now what does that do to your average company that's now got to keep, their data storage needs just tripled?
Yeah, I mean, it's well, I think this is going to be a landmark case to set precedent for people training models in a number of cases. And like, and now that I so the way that I mean, I do not train trillion parameter language models the way that OpenAI does, but I train smaller models, machine learning models, I fine-tune embedding models, I've fine-tuned language models like Llama 3. You take the case of training an embedding model on synthetic data, right? You generate a bunch of questions based on the chunks of text in your documents using a larger, more powerful language model, and then you train the embedding model on those synthetically generated questions to match the question to the chunk of text that the question was supposed to be about. When I was doing this, I was generating new questions after I was changing my prompt, like literally dozens of times a day. And because I'm playing around, I didn't even think about it. I was overwriting the JSON file on my file system every single time. But if you generate that embedding model based on, some questions about a specific piece of text that you got from New York Times, and then you just keep overwriting the JSON file, it's totally, I mean, I do not have I have the models that I trained, and I do not have the data that I use to train those models in these cases. I do not have lineage to track, like this version of the model corresponds with this version of data that I trained it on. And so the idea that a frontier research lab is doing the same thing at scale when data sets are terabytes in size and models are trillions of parameters, which is terabytes of in size on the file system, and they've got thousands of researchers and they don't want to maintain hundreds of petabytes of data. Like it's actually totally reasonable to me that the embedding model OpenAI was using 2 years ago that they deprecated is like literally just gone. Some version of Ada is gone, and there was hundreds, if not thousands, of data sets that were used to potentially train versions of Ada while it was being created. So I'm not coming out here and defending, but like when you enforce a legal hold, I think it applies to things that you're describing, like emails, documents, and stuff. And I don't know if there's precedent to hold a training data set for models, because where would the precedent be? A self-driving car company getting sued by somebody because,
They ran
of a
over someone.
certain the model did, right?
Yeah.
What data did that model get trained on? The fraud detection model, the recommendation engine that told somebody to, buy a product or not give somebody a loan and then they get sued or something like that. It's like, I don't
Google
think there's
telling
a lot of
people to put
precedent
glue
for
on
this.
pizza to make the cheese stick.
Well, let's move into the next one, right? There was another article about Jensen from NVIDIA saying that we're years away from AI that we can largely trust.
What up?
What are we doing here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a reality check for a lot of people, right? Like, if you're a user and someone who like uses large language models on a regular basis, you've seen an incorrect answer. You've seen something that you're like, eh, that doesn't look right. Or, where is it pulling this information from? And consider that for, let's say, any given use case, there could be thousands of potential users all prompting, throughout the day. You're going to have a high probability that the model's going to get it wrong, right? A certain number of times a day. And so I think Jensen's kind of giving people a reality check that, like, hey, like, yes, we're seeing a lot of great use cases. And yes, I'm a very rich man and everybody wants to buy my chips. But he's taking the hype back down to reality a little bit, I think.
Yeah, so I would like to see him put a finer point on this. I think he's obviously correct. He's at least directionally correct in just about everything he says. You can learn a lot from listening to the guy. And the success of the company kind of reflects that. The fact that he says specifically in like the quote from this article is we have to get to a point where the answer that you get, you largely trust. But specifically the implication when he says pre-training, quote, just taking all of the data in the world and discovering knowledge from it automatically is not enough. Just as going to college and graduating from college is a very important milestone, but it's not enough. There's a big difference between the model itself and an AI-powered application, right? I'll make a completely different analogy. I was worked on a project a number of years ago where people were counting the number of pigs that came off a truck, right? And so if you looked at a model, it was like 97% accurate at performing the semantic segmentation of the pig. There was 3% of the pig that wasn't in it, or the segmentation mask was covering stuff that wasn't pig. But in terms of accuracy of discovering how many pigs come off the truck, it was effectively 100% accurate. Because even if the semantic segmentation is a little bit off, like you're never missing an entire pig with this thing, right? And so there's some analogy back to LLMs where when I use Perplexity, if I am trained to double check the source, and basically use it as a better, more coherent version of Google search. And as a user, I don't just immediately take what it says and immediately use it. I go and click the links, I read where it got the answer from, and then I get my answer that way. I've never had a Perplexity search that returned something completely useless. Maybe I refined the search if it wasn't perfect. Maybe, you know, Google would have done better or whatever. But mostly, Perplexity does better than Google, and therefore it's a better product, and I keep using it. And so, I mean, are we going to get to the point where the model itself just gets every single math question ever asked it correct out of the box? Probably not. But is it still going to be useful? Yeah. And I think the AI-powered application that uses an LLM to teach kids math is already largely useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to say, hear Jensen say something like, models are not enough. We need to build LLM-powered applications that are largely trustworthy, and this will be done by more than just pre-training a model, which I think is what he's saying, but it's not like explicit that he's calling on the larger world of software engineering and, you know, product development to build AI-powered applications that are trustworthy and focus on trust instead of just building cool demos that, you know, break down in spectacular ways. Kind of what we're doing right now.
There's also there's a component of like train the user as part of this, right?
Exactly,
like, you know, it's going to get to a point where, or I think people want it to get to a point where, like you said, right, you open up Perplexity, you prompt it, it gives you the information. Maybe you don't click the source links anymore, right? Because you're like, you know what, actually that's correct. That's what the information that I wanted to know, or that's the summary that I wanted to know, right? Like, it's getting to that point, I think, too. And to what you said, where that comes from is like building these AI-powered applications that are actually useful for certain tasks, which I don't know, in my limited experience playing around with Microsoft Copilot, for example, I can honestly say that Microsoft has some work to do. just my personal opinion that it's not great as what they're selling it. So we basically have to fix that problem first, I think, before we can, you know, actually get to the point that we're talking about. But what's interesting is like, you know, that article that I sent you that's super related to this was, you know, JP Morgan CEO saying that we're basically going to work 3.5 days a week and live to 100 because of AI, right? Because of these AI powered applications that are going to be hitting the market, and basically, you know, the whole work smarter, not harder, you know, mentality, right? And so he appears to be quite bullish on we will get there, right? And we'll get there within, you know, a generation basically or less.
Yeah, we've already seen these trends in broad strokes where if you say like, go back 200 years, people were primarily farming. Mm-hmm. There was not a lot of industry, certainly around the world, but even places like Canada and the US where we live. There's a specific thing that I kind of like to compare it to. I mean, in those days, there was royalty who would have certain, you know, pleasures. There would be a tailor to help them get, you know, a perfect suit and look nice and be like clean and hygienic. They would have people serving them meals and kind of cleaning up after them in the household. And they might have a, you know, like go back all the way to like Napoleonic times. You've got horse and buggy, like you've got a carriage and other people can't afford a horse and whatever. And then you fast forward to today, and a lot of those creature comforts I was describing are accessible to like just about everybody in Canada and the US. You've got, heating and AC in the home you live in. You can order a delivery pizza and not cook. You can go, if you have enough money, you can go hire somebody to clean your home. And there's your car, right? Or you take the bus. So the trend over time is that all of this stuff that's been automated away has been kind of repetitive manual tasks where machinery can automate things away. But we're getting to the point where it's now the knowledge work. It's repetitive cognitive tasks that are being automated away. Now, I don't really, if I'm rich, I could hire an accountant and they do my taxes for me. And now, like, TurboTax and stuff exists and it kind of is accessible to everybody for a much lower price. I just think that's going to be what we've seen is that that's going to apply to domains of creativity. Anybody can go and generate art. We can clip up this show and post it on YouTube and without knowing anything about video editing, right? I can keep coming up with examples, but there's ways in which language models are automating away creative writing tasks. You can, it's hard to differentiate who's actually got a strong, IQ in the domain of grammar and the written word and things like that. A crazy one with AI recently is the live translation of the voice, right? It seems like it's going to enforce more, it's going to stop people from learning other languages because, hey, I went to Japan on a ski trip last year and I tried to get around and my buddy, we had to get his boot fixed and I didn't even try and struggle to learn some Japanese words because I could just talk into the phone and it could translate it perfectly to the people who didn't speak English and they then translate what they said back to me. And I could imagine myself getting around there for 3 months without ever really putting in an effort because, the phone kind of does it for you. So where do translators go and things like that? It's anyway, I got a lot of thoughts about the future of work and certainly believe it's trending towards this, UBI future that Jamie Dimon imagines. But I also believe that people, generally speaking, people like to find things to do. And
Of
I've been
course.
having fun doing more creative things with AI rather than kicking back and relaxing because AI can write some emails and write some code for me.
You bring up on the creative writing front, actually I just saw this morning. I love the headline of it, but half of that thought
Oh,
leader crap
100%.
on LinkedIn is AI scribbled. But it's true. Like, it is amazing to me how much of LinkedIn and Instagram and all these other social media platforms is, as you would call it, AI slop.
It's
Like
total slop, dude.
it's like people, but it's crazy. People are making money by just prompting a model to create some stupid video, image, whatever, and then putting it out there along with a sponsorship and getting money from it. Wild to me. What else is wild to me is like, and I think I can't remember. I think we have talked about it on a previous episode. Mechanical Turk, right? Amazon paying people like for very to complete very, minor tasks like labeling images or whatever, right?
It's
I just
and scale AI, like an entire company that does this as their whole business is the same as AWS's Mechanical Turk feature, but
Well,
whatever.
it appears Uber is now going to pay people to label images now, right? Like now the company that you call when you're too drunk to drive home is now getting into AI labeling of images, which I thought is just like wild, but it kind of makes sense when you consider that they have an entire ecosystem of gig workers who are already used to the mindset of I log into an app, I do my task, when I'm done, I just close the app, right? You have people that are already used to that mindset and that's how they work. And so I think it's kind of genius in a way.
I mean, they've already done this. Okay, not really in the same way, but when they started showing ads as you're waiting for your ride to show up and you're looking at your phone, I was like, oh man, this is obvious. Every company has an opportunity to become a ad-driven company the way Google is. And it's just about execution. And then I got in airplanes and now they're showing me like Rolex commercials or whatever before the flight attendant gets on to do a
Safety
the safety
demonstration.
demonstration.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, oh man, the entire world's gonna be advertising now. But the like monetization of people's attention is a pretty important thing that like Uber is fundamentally a taxi company, and why do you take Uber and in many cases pay a premium to take Uber? Because you know exactly where the car is. You don't have to tap and negotiate with the driver as you're getting out. You have the star rating. Everybody's civil to each other. Like, this is a better experience than a taxi by like clicking the app and seeing where the driver is, right? And people who kind of say, oh, like it's just tech guys trying to take out taxis, I think they underestimate how much people in the modern age enjoy the aspect of convenience I was kind of referring to when I was talking about the automation of manual labor away. Like, why are people paying so much extra to order delivery takeout through the Uber app instead of just calling the restaurant? Well, because people like to scroll through and look at seven different restaurants and then have a
Sure.
discount shown to them and then click this and add that. Uber Eats is a pretty good experience. I still
Well,
don't use it, but it seems
yeah,
good.
what's interesting too, though, is specifically about the taxi industry is first they responded to Uber by litigating and lobbying. They're like, we need to destroy these people any way that we can. Fast forward to today, now there's an app called Curb that basically mimics the Uber experience, but for taxis. So it's like first they tried to beat them and they lost. So they're like, it's like that old saying, if you can't beat them, join them. They've joined them, right? They've tried to compete by giving the user a similar experience. Maybe it's not good enough. Maybe I can't also order food from it, but the base functionality of I am ordering a car from an app to pick me up and take me to where I want to go, that experience is what they've mimicked with Curb.
And it makes sense, man. I think there's going to be a long kind of drawn out thing. Let me go back to one point earlier about like AI is writing the slop on LinkedIn. It's not so I think a lot of people use AI wrong and it gives me a bad taste in my mouth, and then I either just block them or try to not look at their stuff in the future because I don't want to read that. But I've had the personal experience of writing the blog, asking AI for feedback, or give me an outline with these five things or whatever. And so having it as the true co-pilot or assistant just makes my writing better. It still feels like my voice. I think people read it with my voice, but there's a suggestion aspect to it there. The other thing is that it's not just about typing and prompting. I follow this guy Jason Liu on Twitter, who's he's got this course on retrieval augmented generation. He's awesome. Anyway, the th he made a comment at one point about how he's basically generated his entire blog with speech to text, like a system that he set up where he is personally used to, it seems to me, to used to like giving presentations or talking about a subject
Sure.
and not used to just literally using his fingers to type things down.
Yeah.
So he kind of gets on, talks about the things that he knows. A whole transcription gets spit out by a really good model that he doesn't really look at, and then he goes in back and edits it, right? And it could be manual edits or it could be an AI-driven edit. And that workflow to me is just such an obvious way because I can, freeform think and talk with more coherent thoughts than I can typing. Like it would take me longer to write a long blog post that takes somebody 5 minutes to read or 10 minutes to read than it would to give a 10-minute presentation on a topic. Either because that's what I do in my job more, or because I'm just more of like a auditory teacher. I don't know. But it's experiences like that that when he described it, I thought in my mind, okay, I got to get Whisper running locally on my laptop because the Apple speech to text thing in the iPhone sucks. It's like the okay, I've got this Copilot that can generate images or generate a quick storyboard or generate a PowerPoint, and then I've got this thing that can take my speech and turn it into text, and then I've got this writing assistant that can craft it into a nicely formed blog post. I'm like, the amount of high quality content that people are going to be able to, first of all, consume through Perplexity or something, and then regurgitate onto some, nicely created thing. Right now, kind of takes the form of LinkedIn slop, but I think the positive spin on it is that it's just so much easier to learn new things and so much easier to teach people things now. And that trend's got to just continue over time. So we've got to get to the point where, like, there's some place between read a book, sit down and read a textbook for an hour, and Neuralink literally download the textbook into my brain, and now I know the things. That point in the middle feels like I'm going for a run, and there's a podcast about this technical subject that's going on, Notebook LM style. And then I get back, and I can talk something through. And maybe the interface for AI is not typing on a keyboard the way these guys say. Maybe it is the voice thing, right?
I mean it. I'm right there with you on the whole like blog post versus just talking about it, right? Like I'm very much and have been for a long time. Instead of me trying to explain something to you over a Slack message, like I'm just going to pick up the phone and call you and take 30 seconds and explain it to you because it honestly would be longer for me to type it out in a way that you can comprehend, right? Like it would just it's shorter of a time for me to just call you and say it, right? And I think that also applies to maybe where AI should go, right? I mean, there's obviously been like Amazon Alexa was a very public failure, right? And Amazon has even said as much. Because it basically it's not super helpful. It's not like it doesn't achieve the vision that they wanted when they first set out to build it. And now they're going and spending a bunch of money to make it better, right? Like a new version of it that they're then going to charge people for. You've got two tiers of Siri now, right? You have the base Siri that everyone gets for free, and then you have the AI Siri that is a monthly fee, right? Like you're going to start to see more of that. And that's at the point where I think of voice assistants actually become more useful.
Yeah, totally agree. This does lead us to the buzzword, agents.
Agentic.
So, a couple of good comments here. Hamel Hussein had a tweet: "Agentic is the new big data." And then he followed it up: "Whether you or not you think that's a good thing depends on your perspective." Bracket, vendor versus engineer. And then somebody responds, it's an interesting analogy. William Horton, he says, "Personally, I've been thinking that AI agents is a new distributed microservices. Every company wants to say they're using it. Nobody knows exactly what to do with it. And there are almost definitely simpler approaches they should have tried first."
That's fantastic. It's like McKinsey came in and told us our path to profitability is Kubernetes. So what are we doing for Kubernetes?
Profitability is AI agents.
Yeah, our path to
Oh my God, man.
profitability is agentic AI, whatever. How many buzzwords can we cram into this stupid presentation? Like that's I 100% agree that that seems to be a little bit of like every time we've had a, and we've talked about this on prior episodes, but like every time we've had a big like buzzword like this, like cloud or big data or, go back through the last 10 years, there's like 1,000 of them, right? That people have like coined and everybody now wants to talk about, right? Like there were 100% much simpler ways to solve challenges than like we're gonna go like so remember when OpenStack came out and everyone was like I'm gonna go run my whole business on OpenStack and then they find out that what's distributed on GitHub is basically only 80% complete, and it's up to you to literally code the other 20%. And people go, oh, wait a minute. I got to hire all these full stack developers now who have to know like 15 programming languages that make up OpenStack, and I have to develop this myself. Like, hold on, this is not cost saving. Like, this is a massively complicated thing that I just stepped into. And I feel like that's been a lot of people's experience. When cloud was a buzzword, right? And everyone's like, what's your cloud strategy, right? Like, okay, my cloud strategy is I'm going to throw everything into AWS and hope the bill doesn't suck. Like, that basically was the route that everybody took. And now the conversations I have are, how do we move it back?
Yeah.
Because we moved it all there and we fired everybody. And so how do we move it back? Like,
yeah.
And that was, so that evolution happened over 10 years. People, I feel like now today, people are finally like, they understand cloud, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, they figured out how to operationalize it. They figured out what the right balance is.
You know, what's like, define cloud here. It's a hard question. Let me throw out my definition of cloud. Things that are sticky, right? Infrastructure as code, like make an API call and then have a machine, right? Pay for what you use, and then like limitless scale. I don't need a 3-month procurement horizon or whatever.
Right.
Those things are sticky and people want that, right? Is there something else, or is that kind of a summary of what you mean by cloud? Because this is another term like agentic that I need, every time I talk to somebody about it, I need to clarify what's your personal view of what cloud means? And some people it's like, well, the server is, somebody else owns the server and I just rent it.
Right.
Well, that's hosted services and that's existed for 40 years.
Like, yeah, I think the summary that you just gave is exactly what I mean when I say cloud. It's the experience. It's the like point, click, receive virtual machine type experience. I think that people like have wanted to figure out, right? And I think that everyone was talking about it. Nobody was really doing it. And the ones that were doing it were not doing it very well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially in the early days. And it took us like, you know, a decade to basically figure out a set of what I would call best practices, right? Like, learn from everyone's collective mistakes, do this and not that, right? So with every single one of these, another great example, like going, you know, big data, right? When that was a hot buzzword, I can't tell you how many Hadoop grids that I built and designed, and now I'm ripping them all out.
Yeah.
Like, so, it's...
yeah, I want to get back to that. But I think the thing about cloud is that I become a bit of a gatekeeper in terms of the word, where it's like, and I think it's Hamill's point about whether you're a vendor or an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to call something cloud, I would be of the mind that if I can't make an API call, or if you don't have a CLI, you're not allowed to call it cloud, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to start a new instance of a virtual machine, a database, some networking service programmatically. It can't be clicking, right?
Yeah.
And then the kind of pay for what you use experience needs to be there. It can't just be like, oh, I'm giving you infrastructure as code, but you have to give me $1 million before you start using it, sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an interesting way in which I would gatekeep agentic AI if I knew more about it, basically. Like, to me, an agent is an LLM calling a function or using a tool, right? Like, the user makes one natural language query, and then the model turns around and it can, you know, recursively call itself basically, or make API calls and then use the response.
Yeah.
In other words, like, instead of the model directly calculating the answer to a question, it would take the question from the user, use the tool calculator, get the response, and then craft that, synthesize the response to somebody. The same way it might, you know, make a SQL query, the same way it might use an embedding model for RAG or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
the idea of AI agents has seemed to take on this, business think boy context of like what I was describing earlier, where you've got a speech to text agent, you've got a blog post writing agent, you've got a coding agent, and they all are just like your minions working for you who do things like automate away your job. And a fully self-contained quote unquote agent with an interface that you work with, like, I don't know if that exists. And if it does, I don't know if that's useful. And I definitely don't think that's what technical people mean when they describe agentic RAG, for example, which is, basically making many LLM calls to provide one output for a user.
Yeah. So the whole, like, my limited understanding, I guess, of what you would boil down to a definition of agentic AI is basically just a class of AI systems that are designed to operate autonomously, right? I think that a lot of this, much like, the evolution of all of these other buzzwords over time, is literally just people trying to manifest it, right? Like, it doesn't exist. They want it to exist, so they're going to start making a lot of noise about it. And then all of the researchers and the entire community is going to go, oh, well, if I want to make money in this space, I got to go to where the buzzword's going. So now I got to start developing agentic AI. Like, it's literally, I think a lot of it right now is just people trying to, like, manifest it into existence.
Yeah, it's a lot of, but yeah, making me think of another thing. There's a quote from a, I forget where the article was or something. Oh, no, it's a book called Boom. Somebody's quoting this book. Today, AI-powered chatbots can book a flight to London while riding the New York City subway. But the subway was built early last century, and the flight will take longer than in the 70s. The infrastructure of the world behind our smartphones is deteriorating, right? And then another guy responds with a comment that, this fallacy explains a lot of AI hype, which I think is kind of what you're describing right now. The barriers to actually doing real-world tasks efficiently are rarely computational. They're usually physical, economic, social, political. You could make the computational part 10 times faster, yet making the overall system more efficient only happens by 1%. So, yeah, I think there's an interesting way in which this is going to apply to knowledge work. I think a lot of people are like, oh, AI is so great. Why can't it wash my car and do the dishes and take the kids to school? And it's like, well, anybody who spent any time with technology is like, it wasn't designed for that problem and it's not good at that problem that you're describing. But the things that it is being used for, if you keep it within that scope, are like fascinating, right? NVIDIA released this model, Fugato. Remember this thing that I sent you? The world's most flexible sound machine. Literally give it a text prompt and it will change the sound effect, the noise that you're working on. And I think I sent this to you and you were like, okay, SFX is dead.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the first thing I thought of, right? Because, like, I've done SFX, right? So, like, it's this whole concept of, like, I go in a big open room and smash a watermelon with a hammer, and then I can morph that using some sort of audio software, EQs, filters, etc., to sound like a human head getting crushed, right? Like, that's the output, right? And so, like, if I'm just able, let's say I'm an independent filmmaker, I've got a limited budget. If I'm able to basically do my entire sound effects for the whole movie by just prompting a model, like, that's crazy. And also, like, kind of a big deal.
I mean, and for this, I would encourage people to just go look at the article that we'll link in the chat and just listen to the stuff that this generates with these text prompts. Like, it's obviously a demo, but I mean, the researchers who are working on it comment on the article, that their demo is to prompt the model to create an electronic music song where dogs are barking in time to the beat. Okay, it's like, and they said, when the group broke up with laughter, it really warmed our heart. I mean, so this is one of those comments from earlier, you know, it's a demo, right? But the so the sound effects engineer is still going to fold its own, his or her own laundry, but now they can prompt a model to create dogs barking to the beat. It's not really
Well,
what people have in mind when you talk to the average person who's doesn't spend time thinking about these models.
yeah, and I mean, I'm only half kidding when I say like SFX is dead, but like I think the truth to it ends up looking more like what we just talked about, where it's being used as like a co-pilot, where it generates the initial sound, and then the SFX engineer takes that into Pro Tools or something and tweaks it from there and makes it, slightly different. Maybe the model didn't get it 100% correct with the sound that they were imagining they wanted for that scene in the movie. I think that's more likely what happens.
Yeah, it's the improvement in total quality or total throughput from the one engineer, but not necessarily removal of the human in the loop.
Yeah.
I remember a number of years ago, probably like 10 years ago now, when ResNets were really popular, and people were using them for like image classification tasks, cancer, not cancer, and people are like famous, really thoughtful, like Geoffrey Hinton famously was like, do not go study radiology. Radiologists are dead,
Our
basically.
dad, yeah.
The way you just said SFX is dead. And maybe people listen to him. I don't think a lot of people in the broader world know who Geoffrey Hinton is. Even people who are, you know, in medical school. But like radiologists are still making like $700,000 a year in the US. Like there's a
Yeah.
huge shortage of them. So I don't know what the whole, I don't know why. Well, I do know why, but it's interesting that people give, you know, technical people, engineers, research scientists who know the details of how the models work so much, give their thoughts so much credence when it comes to predicting the future of work or the future of life, as if, you know, these people really know a lot about how the average person lives their life. Like, in my experience, even myself, you know, I go talk to friends and I've been stewing in this AI thing and I use words like Claude and Perplexity, and like friends who are software engineers don't know what I'm talking about. That's not really, I'm making some points that I, you know, saw on Twitter earlier. Again, but like, you know, there's no way my parents, my, you know, my family, like, knows the details of how this AI stuff work. So if I'm going to come and be like, radiologists are dead, don't study radiology, they're just going to outsource their decision making to me as the, you know, person who knows something about how the AI works. And maybe I'm outsourcing it to Dr. Hinton. But it's a very narrow, it's still, everybody has a very narrow perspective. And, you know, the technology being good at a demo is totally different than it being widely adopted at scale, making people more productive, things like that.
Yeah, my sister-in-law is a X-ray tech, right? And she's still employed. She's still taking pictures, taking scans, putting them up for charts. Like nothing's changed. And in fact, I remember specifically hearing about, probably around that time period, there was like a big push for like, image detection can detect tumor growth with, this much accuracy, and that's more accurate than a radiologist can do it, and blah, blah, blah. And as far as I know, I'm not seeing like Texas Children's Hospital and the Mayo Clinic and these like super prominent research hospital organizations that are on the bleeding edge of technology adopting it.
Yeah, no,
I'm not seeing it.
let me put this in perspective for Canadians. I've seen this before. I just went and found this document. The whole thing is, sorry, the whole document is the Canadian Medical Imaging Inventory Service report. the age of imaging equipment in Canada. And on page two, there's a table, the average age of imaging units by modality in 2019 to 2020. The average age of a CT machine is 8.1 years old. The oldest ones in service are 23 years old. There are MRI machines that are 20 years old. 8.6 is the average age for MRIs in Canada. SPECT machines, 13.2, average 33 years maximum. I'm not saying Canada in general is on the bleeding edge, right? Certainly not compared to the references you made in the US. But, okay, we got to update the way somebody does MRIs. Well, on average, it's going to be, what, 4 years, 5 years till this 8.6-year-old machine gets replaced? Or the 4-year-old machine gets replaced, right?
Potentially longer, because, I mean, when you consider the fact that these things cost as much as a house, they don't get replaced very often. And honestly, it's only when they break do they get replaced in most cases, because, you know, the hospital's not going, or unless, like, I don't know, Siemens comes out with something that's so compelling and so, like, obvious that everyone should do it, then okay, fine, everyone goes and gets this new MRI machine that's got all these fancy new features, right? But by and large, what that PDF goes to show you is that, like, even if there's something like an AI model that's great and potentially more accurate than a radiologist at doing certain tasks, it's going to be 8, 10, 20 years before we see that in mainstream adoption. And by then, who knows how far things will have changed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you've got to train so many people whose profession in many cases is related to, like, saving lives and the emergency of now. I know some, you know, nurses in my personal life, and they're quite risk averse. And I think for good reason. So
yeah.
Maybe going back to what Jensen said about trustworthy AI earlier as well. All right, where we go from here? You got anything more you want to talk about, or you want to start moving to wrap up?
I did want to start, or I actually did want to bring one more thing up that I think is amazing. In my opinion, a fantastic use of AI. An AI grandma being used to fight against phone scammers. So, you know, O2, phone company, basically created an AI-generated grandma to talk to scammers, right? So instead of you getting the scam call, Daisy, as it's called, gets the scam call and basically wastes their time for 40 minutes to an hour before they basically just give up and hang up. That is amazing, right? Like, I gotta hand it to them. Like, that is a really cool use. I mean, dude, I get probably 5 to 7 scam calls and texts a day. Like, if I could just reroute them all to Daisy and have Daisy just go on and on with boring stories for 45 minutes until these people, you know, hang up the phone out of frustration, I would love that. Like, I'll pay money for it, right? Like, if AT&T came to me and said, hey, it's going to be an extra $5 a month, but we'll have this AI bot waste the scammer's time for you, I'll pay it.
Now you're dreaming. Yeah. Now you're dreaming. yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a perfect use of AI that saves us time, and the downsides are, well, okay. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, this is kind of exactly what you or we've just talked about, which is there's a simpler way to solve this. We don't need to train a language model and power a bunch of GPUs to have grandma talk to these guys. We could, if you know who the, if you can identify who they are, freaking block the guys. Do
Yeah, no, I
some,
know.
shut them down, right?
Well, and that's happened too, right? I mean, there have been large scam call center companies, especially recently, that have been shut down, very publicly. And so I think that that's not going away. And you're right, that is the simpler way to solve it. I would say, though, it's the AI grandma is definitely a more creative way. I'll give it that.
To keep them on the phone while you're
Yep.
collecting some data. That's,
But you're right.
well,
It
look,
there's a much simpler fix to that problem.
if you
Is
can
it still
identify
cool?
who to put grandma on the phone with,
Yeah.
you can block the
Right.
calls. Like,
100%.
basically, because my mind immediately went to, okay, what's the way in which this can backfire? Well, you get a call from mom, and suddenly they're talking to this scammer payback grandma. Now your mom's like, who's at your house? What's going on? She was telling me all this stuff. No. You get a call from a friend who's home visiting people in India, and it routes it to the scammer payback grandma. And now you gotta,
Well, I mean,
got some issues.
I see this playing out in one specific way and one way only. The scammers then build their own bots so that they're not even the ones calling. Automated calling has been a technology for like 30 years, right? Like, and so now we add an AI bot to that, and now I've automated scamming. Like we saw this happen when ChatGPT came out. How did they respond? They built fraud GPT, right? They literally have their own, chatbot for committing fraud. It's like this is how it ends, right? So now what do we get to, right? We get to AI grandmas wasting the time of an AI scammer. Like is that what we get to?
An agentic scammer.
Sorry, agentic, forgot. That's the hot new word.
No, and they have there's this guy making an AI bot do sales calls for him. He was posting about that this week, which I think is honestly super interesting. And he clarified that when he starts the call, he has the bot notify the person on the phone that they are AI. And I was thinking about this earlier. I am so surprised by how interested and, accommodating people are when they're working with AI. Like, imagine getting a sales call from somebody that's like, "Hi, this is AI. I'm going to talk to you about this product." Like, I would listen. I'd hear it out. I'd ask some questions. I'd see what it says, right?
I would try to like do prompt injection on it or something to see if it can like divulge some information that I'm not supposed to hear.
I'd want to, but yeah, hey, good job. Nice job this week. Gotta wrap
Yeah,
up here,
no,
but
this is good.
talk to you soon.
Yep, sounds good. See you on the next one.